Welcome to another exciting episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the Brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies, we'll reach in there, we'll pull the baby out, clip the cord, but not in a creepy way.
Oh no. That's creepy just hearing it.
Awkward.
Okay.
The beginning.
Are we ready? Okay, here we go. Me. So welcome, this is Eric.
This is Brother Jay.
And tonight we're going to talk about the fantastic 2005 film Capote, directed by Bennett Miller, and starring one of the greatest actors in our generation, I think, Philip Seymour Hoffman. He just nails this. I mean, he becomes Truman Capote for the movie, as far as I'm concerned.
It was really quite an amazing transformation. Although, since you pointed out to me that there was another movie, inexplicably a year later, I think, Infamous came out.
Yes.
So, and Toby Jones looks and sounds more like Capote in the preview. So I haven't seen Infamous, so I don't know. But certainly Philip Seymour Hoffman, I had no problem immersing myself in the movie Capote, believing it was Capote.
Well, this movie, I think Philip Seymour Hoffman's character as Capote was less, I guess, flamboyant, maybe.
Yeah.
Than the Toby Jones character. I mean, he was over the top. He was, you know, that was a book based on George Plimpton's memory of Truman Capote and all the fabulous things he did. So this was more of an introspective piece.
So would you say that Capote is more of the drama, where Infamous is more of kind of a dramedy?
Well, I haven't seen Infamous in a while, and I didn't get the idea that it was comic necessarily.
Because the preview made it out to seem very, you know, Capote was freewheeling and footloose and kind of a player, and then the thing happened, you know, In Cold Blood happened, and then that changed him. But so it's hard. Like I said, I only saw the preview of Infamous, so I'll probably watch that in the next couple of weeks just for some compare and contrast. But this movie was definitely. This was definitely a drama.
Oh, yeah. This was a lot of internal acting, too, for Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yeah. And it was a very beautiful film. It was very dark. And, I have some poor association with this movie, though, but,
Do you want to get into that now or save it for the end?
No, we can. I tend not to go to movie theaters because I hate people and I worked at a movie theater. So, because of that, at the time, in the early 2000s, especially, when DVDs were cheap before they were Blu-rays, and, you know, I worked at Fred's and I got a discount, so I would buy new DVDs when I really wanted to see a movie, because it was, you know, they'd $9.99 on sale, and so I'd buy one if I really wanted to, and Capote was one, that I wanted to see, you know. And so Derek and I, it was like a Sunday night. We went shopping at Fred's and we bought Capote and we bought pizza rolls of all things. And we came home and we watched, Capote and ate pizza rolls. And I was like, this is, you know, great movie. And then by the end of the evening, and I think it was fall or winter when it came out, but I can't remember, on DVD. And I felt horrible. And next thing I know, I am like projectile vomiting pizza rolls. And I have come down with the flu.
Oh, no.
And I spend the next 3 days, like, dead to the world, missed 3 days consecutively of work, which I hadn't done at that point ever in my lifetime. So it was just this strange, like, I'd passed out on the bathroom floor, and the dog was curled up to me because he thought I was dying. And so it was just strange. So for the longest time, I didn't go and rewatch this movie just because I had that bad association. Also, couldn't eat pizza rolls anymore. So
I was going to say, have you ever eaten a pizza roll since?
I have since. I cannot eat the Fred Meyer brand ones, which are what I bought. I can't bring myself to eat the Fred Meyer ones ever again. Derek's like, could have been food poisoning. I'm like, it happened too fast to be food poisoning. Anyway, way, way far afield. So that was my association. So I hadn't seen this movie in the theater. I watched it at home, and Derek and I really loved it. And then when I watched it again the other night, I was struck by, I was totally immersed in the movie. It drew me in. It captivated me. It kept me going. And I didn't lose interest in the movie at all. There was never really a slow spot where the movie lets up. It's kind of relentless and driving. And even though there's not a lot of action, there's a lot going on.
Oh, absolutely. And the characters, the acting they do is sometimes very, very subtle, but it works so well.
Yeah. And some of it's very uncomfortable to watch, though.
Oh, yeah. Well, it turns out, you know, Capote isn't, he may be the protagonist in the story, but he's not necessarily the nicest guy with the best motives.
No. At no point in this movie do I ever feel that he's a good guy. He's a bad man.
Well, I don't know if he's bad. He's broken. And he's willing to use people.
Yeah, he's very driven and, So anyway, we can go into that. I have 3.5 pages of notes. So.
Oh, well, fantastic. Shall we just drive into the plot then?
Sure.
Okay. Well, what we have is, in Kansas, a family friend discovers the dead bodies of 4 members of the Clutter family. The opening in the movie, by the way, I thought they showed this scene. There's hardly anything gruesome shown at this part of the movie. It's just so effective, the reaction shot of the friend that finds the family.
Agreed.
And it's a nice way to kind of slowly get into the movie. Anyway.
The movie itself isn't about the killings as much as it is the killers.
Exactly. And more so even just how Capote deals with writing about the killers.
Right.
Now,
In Cold Blood is completely a separate work. It's only pertinent to this in as much as it was integral to who Capote was.
Oh, exactly. And the book itself is really good. I mean, it actually changed the way you could write about a true story. It was like a novelization of a true story. Capote got involved right from the beginning because here's how he gets into the story. He's reading the New York Times, the story about the Clutters, gets his attention, and so Truman Capote, Philip Seymour Hoffman, calls the New Yorker magazine editor, William Shawn, who's played by National Treasure Bob Balaban, to tell him that he plans to document the tragedy. Now, Capote then goes to Kansas and he invites along his childhood friend Nell Harper Lee, famously Harper Lee, who wrote To Kill a Mockingbird, and pretty much nothing else. And this is she is played by Catherine Keener, who does an excellent job in this movie too. She is
and I really like her as an actress. So.
Oh, me too. Now Sandra Bullock plays the Harper Lee role in Infamous. And she was considered for the role in this movie, too. So it's interesting that she may have something to do with making Infamous, too. Sorry, Infamous also. She may have something to do with the production of Infamous because she didn't get this job. Of course, a lot of this stuff comes from the IMDb trivia section, which is not 100% reliable. So anyway, I interrupted talk of the wonderful Catherine Keener to bring Sandra Bullock into it.
Yeah, you're a bad man.
Well, Sandra Bullock is fine. I like Sandra Bullock a lot. But, yeah, Catherine Keener is a jewel.
Sandra Bullock's okay. A little of her goes a long way with me. So, but yeah. And then the striking thing, In Cold Blood is only, the paperback version is 343 pages long. I have the Audible audiobook version of it. And it's 14 hours. So it's incongruous to me that it's 343 pages long, but it's 14 hours. But regardless, if you haven't, if anybody hasn't read the book or listened to it, it will alter you for the better, I think, because it's a dark story. It's a sad story. But it's very rich. And Capote, for all of his shortcomings and flaws as a human being, he really, his writing style was just I haven't had a book like that that really drew me in quite as much as In Cold Blood did. So,
oh, it is absolutely great, and I highly recommend it as well. And it, there's a lot more. Again, this the In Cold Blood is about the killers and the family too. It talks a lot about the Cullerters, but it talks a lot about the two guys who did this murder, and it follows them quite a ways until they eventually were caught. And in this movie, you pretty much, they're caught right away as far as Capote's concerned. Because his involvement is he goes to the town to interview the people that are directly affected, the community that's affected by this, because it happens in a small Kansas town. And Nell is there with him, and she's the only way she can charm people into trusting Capote, whereas he can't because he comes in as a complete outsider.
Well, and he insinuates himself into the town and into the people's homes, and I think there's two reactions to that. They're starstruck, and they absolutely give him his way, or they see him as an outsider, and they don't want anything to do with him. There doesn't seem to be much middle ground.
Oh, no, because he comes in as a character. I mean, he is Truman Capote, a character, and he's not going to change himself for this town.
I don't know that he could change himself.
Maybe not. Yeah, maybe not. It's hard because a lot of the interviews that you can find easily online, probably the most famous one is when he's completely drunk, and that's not fair. I mean, drunk late in life interview isn't probably the best way to get to capture the sense of a man.
There is a interview on the disc itself that one of the extras of him from earlier days, talking about writing and his experience. So it's the extras are worth it. I mean, there's three actual parts to the extras, there's a lot of stuff that I wrote down. I was scribbling furiously.
So we have basically one of the ways that Capote gets his information is that he ends up, the Kansas Bureau of Investigators lead detective, Alvin Dewey, played by Chris Cooper, who is awesome, he pretty much brushes Capote off, but then Capote sort of charms Dewey's wife, Marie, because she's a fan of his writing. So they're invited to dinner, and he's very charming, and so eventually he gets into at least a collegial relationship with Alvin Dewey. And it's at this point where he's allowed to view some photographs of the victims, and he's actually having dinner with the Deweys when the murder suspects, Perry Smith, played by Clifton Collins Jr., and Richard Dick Hickok, Mark Pellegrino, are caught. Question for you. Clifton Collins does a great job playing Perry Smith, who is the person that Capote clicks with the most and wants to get the information from. He's more of an artistic kind of guy, with a little more to him intellectually than Hickok. But if you look at pictures, actual photos from the time, some of which you had forwarded to me.
Yeah.
Perry Smith actually is a lot more, I mean, I don't know.
White guy.
No, he's like, seems in the pictures at least to be a lot more handsome and gregarious than the Perry Smith in this movie is.
I agree. They made the Perry Smith character out to be this kind of shrinking violet, shy, damaged dude who was kind of gangly and whatever. And they made, Hickok out to be this, this studly dude. But in reality, I don't know. The pictures don't tell that story. So it's, and of course, I was trying to look for the photo shoot that is referred to. Which happened, but I couldn't find those.
Well, Perry Smith in real life was profoundly bow-legged and walked with a limp. And so that part is alluded to, but really not kind of hammered home. That makes him, more of the damaged character because he's got something to prove. So maybe his upper body is really built and he's got nice hair. But, he knows it's because he's wearing skinny jeans and limping. Again, it would be interesting to revisit Infamous. And actually, watching In Cold Blood, because Robert Blake plays Perry Smith in that movie. to great effect.
I have never seen the movie in cold blood.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's worth watching. I mean, this, you know, the book is obviously better, but it's
that Robert Blake, right?
Yeah. And it's been a while since I've seen it, but I bought it at the same time, I think in the same pack from Costco as I bought Capote. So I watched them all together, and it was very interesting. This was, of course, back in the day. Anyway, so there's some really interesting, like, there's a scene where Capote bribes the warden to let him have unlimited access to Perry Smith. Well, to both guys, really. Which was what sort of a funny scene. And it kind of shows you what this was like, you know, small town, small state in the 60s was like.
Big envelope of money.
Yes. And he just basically gets in there in a prison and ends up talking to Smith and Hickok for months. Now, in the movie Infamous, Perry Smith is played by one Daniel Craig.
Who, in the preview, I barely recognized him.
Well, that's probably a good thing, because you don't want Perry Smith to be James Bond.
Well, and that's my concern, is going back to watch it, we'll see.
And that may be unfair to Mr. Craig.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard. Sometimes it's hard. When you have a role that's gigantic, it's sometimes hard to see the actor pass the role. It can be done, but you just have to kind of set your mind to it as a spectator. So,
well, from now, we've got him in jail with Smith, basically, who Smith is, he likes to use fancy words, and he sketches pictures and things. And so that way they have a connection. And you get the sense that maybe Capote is attracted to Smith. Less in this movie than in the others, but that seems to be something that was thought, I guess, at the time. But also, what this movie really touches on is that he's writing the story about this town, which is going to be into a couple segments in the New Yorker magazine, which then he's going to expand into a book. But he's not really forthcoming with the guys about, like, the title of the book is a big deal and how they're going to be portrayed is a big deal. But he doesn't really, you know, give up all of his cards on what he's doing, because he still wants access to these guys and they could shut him down.
Well, and I think that's why I think that there was a lot, you know, there was a strong affection between Capote and Smith. And I don't think it was ever, I mean, it's hard. No one will know. I don't think it was more than just there was an attraction, but I don't doubt that Capote probably fell in love with Perry Smith. But more like as a brother, because they had some similarities in their childhoods and difficult upbringings. And so I think that there was a connection of kind of a brotherhood that Capote felt, and that's why he felt compelled to come back. Because he paid Hickok some attention, but not as much as he did to the Perry Edward Smith.
So then we have, now we have a problem, because Capote's trying to write this book now, and he's trying to do it in a way that's never done before, but he also has to have an end to this story. And these guys are convicted, and they're sentenced to death, but they have appeals, so they could technically still get off. And he wants, basically, to only publish the book after these guys' death, because that's the end of the story.
But pretty good punctuation mark.
He also wants to be able to get the story of Smith's life and also what happened that night, because Smith hasn't given his account of what happened. I think maybe, now this is where I should have reviewed the book again before we talked about it. But I think basically they blamed each other or something, said it was an accident, robbery gone bad.
It turns out that, because they were both, Hickok and Smith were both criminals. I mean, they were both, you know, low level criminals, but Somebody, I think, one of Hickok's former contacts from jail or prison told him about this family that had all kinds of cash.
Yeah, they had like a safe with $10,000 or something in it.
Right, and as it turns out, they didn't. But you know, they had intended to rob them all, and for whatever reason, spoiler alert. Kind of spoilers if you're ever going to watch In Cold Blood. You know, Perry Smith has Mr.
Clutter,
right?
Yeah.
The father, the you know, Mr. Clutter, was having issues because they'd strung him over like a pipe and his hands were over his head and he was freaking out. And so Perry Smith was, I think, trying to help him. And then for whatever reason, something snapped inside of Perry Smith's crazy brain and he thought the compassionate thing to do was to kill him. And so he slit his throat, but of course he didn't die. Clutter didn't die right away because it takes a while to bleed out. It takes a while for you to kind of exsanguinate. So Hickok panicked because he saw this guy bleeding out and shot him. It's kind of overkill, if you will, if you pardon the pun. You know, because he was going to die anyway, but putting him out of his misery by shooting him. So, but then by that point, when they'd committed a murder, I think both of them are kind of like, well, we're not going to go to the gas chamber, you know, any more times for four people than for one. And so they just killed them all.
Yeah. Including and the children.
Yeah. So, you know, don't have a lot, you know, it's hard to have sympathy, although the movie really tries to make you kind of have sympathy for both of the murderers, but it's hard to have sympathy for them because there was just, you know, the crime that they committed and the town that they irreparably changed and the lives of the people that they touched and ruined and altered forever for $40.
Oh yeah, no, these aren't in no way. There's nothing redeeming about these guys.
No. I don't especially feel bad, again, spoilers. I don't especially feel bad either that they were hanged. So.
Oh no. In fact, now looking at it through 2014 eyes, hanging seems to be a neither cruel nor unusual punishment, considering how lethal injections have been going lately.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's quick and it works.
Yeah. What a mess that is.
And, you know, I'm a bleeding hippie, left-wing liberal, but I have some conflict in my own party because I have mixed feelings about the death penalty because I don't like it because I don't think it's a deterrent. However, I think there are certain people on this planet that just don't need to continue to be on this planet. So I have a hard time. I have a hard time with myself and the death penalty. But
it's hard to reconcile those two things because it's true, and that's how I feel too. And there are definitely evil people in the world.
Well, I think my problem with it is that, and now again, we are tangent.
That's
man.
Fine. No, this is what this podcast is about.
We need a sound effect for. You know, we need a sound effect for Tangent Man.
For riding off the rails.
Exactly. And coming off the rails. I don't have any problem with the death penalty in cases where there's absolute evidence and there's no doubt. The problem I have is where the death penalty is applied, where there is plenty of circumstantial evidence, but not exactly direct evidence, but there's still a conviction. Because those are the kind of things, because you can't unkill somebody.
Well, exactly.
So, you know, in the case of these two where, you know, they basically confess that they did it. There's no doubt that they did it, and it was horrific. I don't have a problem eliminating them from the gene pool. But, you know, we could have a whole debate about how the death penalty is applied more often than not to minorities than to white dudes. And so that's one of the reasons I have a hard time with it is that, you know, we don't have a level playing field in our American criminal justice system. So that's why I'm uncomfortable with the death penalty. However, keeping somebody alive for 50, 60, 70 years in jail isn't exactly humane necessarily either.
That calls into question,
you know, if you believe in an afterlife and there's all kinds of. It's basically a debate lasagna. There's just layer after layer of crazy.
Yeah. And there's also money involved in it. It's expensive to have the death penalty. It's cheaper, actually, to keep people in jail for a very long time than it is to fight endless or seemingly endless court actions because you get mandatory appeals all the way down the line, which is good. Right. I'm not saying you shouldn't.
Yeah.
But gone are the days of, you know, getting convicted and then the death penalty is just taking place anytime in the near future.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, no, that's a whole debate we don't necessarily have to get into. And yeah, it's super complicated. In this case, again, yeah, I don't think anybody thinks that it's bad that these guys were put to death. But, well.
Even Perry Smith's sister was like, no, I don't care.
Yeah, well.
And whether that was dramatic license for the movie or not.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's a different time, too.
Absolutely.
You know, it's also, you know, it's rural America in a different time. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's, you have a different view of life and death on the farm, I imagine.
Yeah.
But, anyway, so, unfortunately, because this case drags on for so long, Capote can't finish his book, and so he drinks a lot. He's feeling sort of lost about the whole thing, and his longtime partner, Jack Dunphy, who's played by Bruce Greenwood, who's awesome.
I love him.
Yeah. No, Jack is great, as portrayed. Actually, Jack and Nell are fantastic friends to him, more than he deserves in a lot of cases.
Absolutely. I wrote down that, like, he is just a dick to Nell. I mean, like, what an ass.
Well,
And then I wrote, poor Jack, always the bridesmaid and never the bride.
Well, yeah, the thing about Nell is, you know, Nell, during this period of time, Nell's book was published, and it did pretty well, and then it became an Oscar-winning movie. And so her star just rocketed, you know. Although she didn't do interviews, she didn't want any part of that being a star thing. But Capote saw that as, you know, he was sort of not able to continue what he thought was going to be his life's work, which turned out to be his best work he's ever did.
Well, the last book he ever wrote.
Yeah, well,
he finished,
yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, I mean,
he never finished another book.
Yeah, that's amazing. But yeah, so he was prevented from getting this, you know, he teased it along as long as he could. But he was getting to the point where if these guys didn't die, he was, you know, it was going to be a horrible thing for him, which is a very greedy thing, you know.
Well, and I wrote down, you know, Capote worried that he was using Perry, except that he absolutely was using Perry. But I wrote down, you know, was Truman in love with the story or was he in love with his own abilities?
Oh, yeah. No, he was, well, at the very end of the movie, when, you know, because at the end of the movie, there's some conflict and about whether he's going to witness the execution.
Right.
Because Perry invites him and he doesn't want to go. He doesn't want to go. But basically Harper Nell tells him over the phone that he's got to go.
And I wrote a note down. I said, I wonder how much Harper Lee really bitch slapped him around in real life. I hope lots.
Yeah. Well, you get the feeling that that was their relationship.
Yeah, you really do. Because she knew how to reach him when nobody else could.
Yeah.
And she knew what he was capable of and knew what kind, I think, I'm speculating. I think she knew what just a huge, you know, douche canoe he could be.
Yeah, no. Nell was Capote's Will to Capote's Jack.
Yeah, and I wrote down, you know, at the execution, I don't know if I could watch an execution ever, but at least there weren't any scissors.
Well, okay, Philip Seymour Hoffman's reaction shot.
Yeah.
Wasn't that amazing?
I think that's pretty amazing, but... So getting into some of the other featurettes in the movie, the scene where Capote is saying goodbye to Perry and Dick in the lot right before they're going to be executed.
Yeah.
When they first kind of talked about the scene, the director and he were talking about you know, how they were going to handle it, and, you know, well, is he going to lose it? Is he going to cry? And he was like, Capote doesn't cry. He's not going to. So Hoffman was like, no, I'm not doing that. I'm not doing any of this. I'm not, you know, no, I'm just going to do this. He's not, Capote wouldn't be necessarily moved by this. He's a selfish man. But so when they went and shot the thing, Philip Seymour Hoffman lost his shit. So what you see is the take.
Oh, that's,
that was
that's
real.
Amazing. Yeah.
You know, he had intended to go into it, you know, one way, but when he got in there, he was so in character that it affected him, and it affected him enough to that whole scene. And that scene was gut wrenching. I mean,
Oh yeah.
It was palpable. And, you know, I've had moments, not, I certainly haven't had execution moments in my life, but I've had moments of pain in my life where I've been dealing with another human being, and that was portrayed so clearly that I could feel exactly what Philip Seymour Hoffman was portraying through Capote. He was channeling it, and I felt it anyway.
Oh, absolutely.
It was riveting. It was just amazing.
Well, this is what a movie should be. You know, yes. We've seen a lot of less than great movies, and we've talked about, you know, a handful of them already, but this movie reminds you what reminded me what movies should do. You know, this movie, it forces you to have a reaction to this story that's being told, but it's not cheap. It's not, I didn't think it was like super manipulative. I just think it was very effective storytelling.
No, and I think it was pretty even-handed because, you know, it didn't make him out to be this great man. It showed that he was a very deeply flawed man with all kinds of troubles that just happened to have some success. And he struggled with that success to the point where the success actually drove him over the edge.
Yeah, and it didn't portray him, though, as the devil either. I mean, he was just a profoundly flawed human being with some really serious talent.
Right.
But one of his talents was, it seems, at least as betrayed, was his ability to turn on being Truman Capote and tap dance around whatever else happened to be really going on.
Right. And then I also wrote down baby food and scotch.
Well, he brought the baby food for Perry, who was on a hunger strike.
Yeah, but seriously, I'm like, who does that? He was an odd man.
It was a simpler time.
Yeah, but by the way, Harper Lee's still alive.
Oh yeah, well, yeah, I didn't know that, but she's very interesting. And have you seen To Kill a Mockingbird, the movie?
Yes.
Yeah.
Gregory Peck, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think I watched it in like junior high school.
Yeah, you know, I avoided reading most of what you were supposed to read in high school by taking all like alternate English classes.
Oh.
Which actually wasn't great because it means I haven't read a lot of the stuff that other people have read. But I just recently saw the movie, and it's a good movie, but it's an odd movie.
Well, it's a very different time.
Oh yeah.
I mean, it's a period piece, but you know, I had the misfortune of being stuck in a damn modern American fiction class, so I was tortured mercilessly with things that I never want to read ever again. A Farewell to Arms, never again.
Well, you know, it's funny because being forced to read, for instance, Huckleberry Finn, mm-hmm. is a different experience than talking to somebody who really at least in my experience, because it's basically just here, read this and we'll tell you what the textbook says are the important points and themes in the story.
Right.
But, you know, unless you have a handle for just how well he did the dialect.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that whole part of the story is fantastic. And, you know, everything kind of around the story is so much more rich. But when you're young and forced to read it, basically just to pass a test, you don't retain it. Right. I didn't retain anything.
No, because you just wanted to get past the test.
Exactly, yeah.
I read the Iliad and the Odyssey in junior high school of my own volition, and it was the best thing I ever did. And I'm glad I did it, but had I been forced to read it, I would have there would have been no way.
Oh, yeah.
There would have been no way I could have accomplished that.
Well, exactly. Because especially with the Iliad, there's a lot of, you know, chapters like that are in the Bible about like numbers and that kind of thing, where you're like, do I really need to read a bunch of pages on how many forces were on one side of the Trojan War? I mean, come on. You know, it was a different time. It was an oral history, and it was, you know... Yeah, so being forced to read something and just being having it recommended to you, I believe, are two different experiences. But it's like being forced to watch a movie versus choosing to watch a movie.
Right.
So, you know, it's a whole different experience. And if anybody feels forced to watch movies, well, that's not going to happen.
It's impossible. You can't enjoy it if you're forced to watch it.
No, of course not. No, and that's why I don't want to force my daughter to watch the movies that I love. However, I do want to introduce her to the movies that I love and explain why I love them.
Right.
So, you know, that's a competing things.
Yeah, because otherwise it's a lot of, like, Fraggle Rock, really, Dad?
Yeah. Or, you know, through the... My fortune of being friends with Sandy, I inherited the entire Muppet Show DVDs.
Wow.
And some of those things are great, and some of them are just weird, and a lot of it is a sensibility that we don't have anymore.
Yeah.
But,
well, and, yeah, it was a different time.
Yeah, exactly. Which is, you know, again, I don't know. It's weird to be a middle-aged guy.
Yeah. So although, I wrote down some notes.
Well, okay. One more thing, though.
Sure.
Because there's one more plot point, and I know I sort of skipped to the end, but the plot point that I thought was really important and just put a button on the whole thing was that after Capote saw the execution and he has like the reaction scene that I thought was really powerful.
Yeah.
He's talking over the phone to Nell about the experience, and he's lamenting that he couldn't have done anything to stop it.
It was a terrible experience. And I will never get over it.
They're dead, Truman. You're alive.
And there wasn't anything I could have done to save them.
Maybe not. Is you didn't want to.
Yeah, again, that's her bitch slapping him.
Exactly. Exactly. So Philip Seymour Hoffman won an Academy Award for this role, and well, he should have.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, he was up against Joaquin Phoenix for Johnny Cash and David Strathairn for Edward R. Murrow. And yeah, they picked the right guy.
Yeah, absolutely. I there wasn't they could not have cast a better person for this role.
Well, and Toby Jones, again, he looks a lot more like Capote, just naturally, and his voice is more like him, so I'll be interested in reviewing it too, but you just believe that Philip Seymour Hoffman was Truman Capote.
Yeah, I don't have any problem believing that.
And he wasn't over the top about it. You know, he had the mannerisms down, but it wasn't, like, offensive.
Yeah, I don't think it was mimicry, and I don't think it was mockery. I think it was probably the best homage. You know, a couple notes I wrote, staring at the dead bodies brings him comfort when he got to see the clutter bodies in the coffins.
Yeah.
And I also wrote down, boy, he sure knows how to bummer down a room.
Capote?
Yeah.
Well, he's the life of the party sometimes.
Sometimes, but he can make fun of himself, but he does not tolerate others who do so.
Well, and, you know, I'm trying to think of somebody who really encapsulates this, because there are people, and that they're very few and far between, you know. They are the Truman Capotes of the world, who are characters. And, you know, who go into a room and change the room by being them.
Yeah.
And who... you know, are good storytellers and who are, you know, very quick. Of course, it's funny because a lot of the people who I know who are the quickest are also some of the meanest people I've ever met. To clarify, actually, I'm thinking of two people in particular who I will not name here. One of whom is actually has passed, but part of being a true, and it's not our grandmother, part of being somebody who is very quick-witted, like have a rapier wit, also is somebody who is comfortable in other people's discomfort.
Yeah.
And that is an incredible tool to have, but it's a horrible thing to have imposed upon you.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't have that. I mean, there are some cases, I'm sure as a younger person, I wish I would have, but I don't think that's a gift.
Well, if it's a gift, it's a mixed blessing.
Yeah.
It also depends on how you choose to apply that gift.
Well, of course, yeah, absolutely.
You know, because if it's aimed sharply, directly to injure, that's not good. But sometimes it's meant playfully to kind of spawn thinking and reason in some people, which sometimes works, sometimes doesn't.
Well, that's the thing. When it works, it's fantastic. I mean, you respect the people that treat you or that teach you lessons in that way when they work, and you hate people who treat you like that and it doesn't work. Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it seems like, Capote would be fun to be around for about the length of 3/4 of a party.
Yeah, as he was well into his cups, it would be time to go.
Exactly, yeah, and you wouldn't want to...
I suspect the more socially lubricated he was with alcohol, the more his behavior just was intolerable and insufferable.
And you would think that 3 or 4 days on a road trip with Truman would be difficult.
Yeah, it makes you really wonder what the time between him and Nell was really like when it was the two of them in a hotel room. Except that I suspect that maybe she just let him drink himself to a stupor and she went out and partied.
It could have been. Or she just, I don't know what a school marm she was. Maybe she was a partier. Maybe, she attended these parties, but it seemed like she didn't get any joy out of them.
Yeah. Well, in the movie, this movie made her kind of aloof as if, the stardom really wasn't what it was about for her. Achieving the success was good for her, and she wanted that, but she really didn't want the stardom in the limelight.
Oh, not at all. Yeah, you definitely got that idea. But she was so, Catherine Keener was just so charming in this role.
Yeah.
You always felt, she was always the only moral compass that Capote had was Nell, who would kind of kick him back into the straight and narrow, or at least show a mirror to him.
So the writer of the screenplay, I don't know if you know anything about him.
I was going to say, I don't know anything about anything. I don't know. You can just stop with, I don't know if you know anything.
Did you ever see the miniseries, I think they play it now all the time on Lifetime, like Judging Amy?
Yeah, it wasn't a miniseries, it was a real series, right?
It was a series, it was a TV series.
I've seen some episodes of it, yeah. Is that the one where Tyne Daly was part of it?
Yes.
Okay.
And so the judge's brother, kind of the crazy Peter, I think his name was Peter on the show, and he was like a drug counselor, and he played a cop at one point, and he was just crazy. But he's the one who actually wrote the screenplay for this.
Oh.
And he's kind of a fascinating guy, because he was moved into doing it after seeing In Cold Blood, or reading Cold Blood, I don't remember which, but he makes the point that the reason that he wanted to make this movie was because in reading In Cold Blood, I think it was when he was reading it, but he said, he realized that the most important character of In Cold Blood wasn't in the book. And so that's kind of one of his reasons for doing this. Philip Seymour Hoffman was their only choice for Capote. When he and the director were discussing casting, that's who they decided on, and they were like, that's it. We're done. This is, if we can't get him, we don't know what we're going to do, but this is it.
Well, what a good cast. I mean, everybody was so good in this movie.
It really was kind of an amazing cast.
I don't think anybody struck a false note.
No, I think you're right. The Clifton Collins character, the Perry Smith character portrayed by Clifton Collins, was not their first pick, but they got a, I guess they got a screen test or something on the last day that they were going to choose. And once they saw Clifton Collins screen test, they were like, that's it. Like, that's him. That's our guy. But they talked a lot, some of the featurettes, which I really, if you ever, I'll have to loan you the DVD.
Oh, no, I have the DVD. I just didn't watch them. I mean.
Oh, yeah. You seriously, it would behoove you to go back and watch them. Answered Prayers is one of them, which actually has an interview with Capote in it. But one of the things they talk about is when they were producing the movie, there was a definitive choice. All of this was filmed, not all of it. They filmed it in Winnipeg, Canada. Because apparently Winnipeg, Canada is still stuck in the 50s. And so it was very much like...
They had the architecture all around?
Well, they talked about it at one point where they were setting that one of the houses, and there was like just a closed-down department store from the 50s that just had furniture in it that they just went and got because the store was closed down and nobody done anything with it in 45 years.
Oh, that's funny.
And the shots looked very much like Kansas and... You know, some of the, getting the, you know, the actors together, some of the extras together. And so they were like, it very much was a very easy fit. It had the same kind of topography and the color palette. But if you watch this movie with obvious exceptions, like taillights of cars, but there was a very deliberate choice in this movie that there's no red and there's no blue.
Yeah. It was almost like a black and white movie. It was very muted tones.
Yeah, and that was a choice. They made a conscious choice. There was no reds and no blues. And obviously, like, things like, you know, stop signs are going to be red. But as far as, like, painting sets and clothes and, you know, surroundings, nothing was red or blue, which is kind of amazing. And some of the shots that you know, the opening shot, which I won't spoil for you. You should watch the featurette. But the opening shot with the, you know, the just against the field.
Yeah, where you get kind of... It kind of shows you the landscape and then where the girl comes into the house.
Yeah. Amazing cinematography.
Oh, yeah. So. I think it was beautiful because it gave you, in one shot, it gave you what you were dealing with. It gave you a picture of this perfect setting of this little rural family in this little rural community. And when they took you through the house with the friend... They didn't show anything really gruesome. All you got were reaction shots. I mean, later in the movie, they showed you the gruesomeness.
Well, and you'll notice in a lot of this movie, the camera didn't move.
Thank God.
A lot of the shots, the cameras were stationary.
Thank God. Oh, I love it. After watching The Frozen Ground, because that's my problem with The Frozen Ground. When you see it, like I said, I liked it, actually. I thought it was well worth watching, and... It was a fine B movie, but the one thing that pissed me off was that camera never stopped moving.
Yeah, and so I think one of the points they made was like, we really wanted the actors in the scene to speak for itself, and so we didn't move the camera a lot.
Well, this wasn't an action-oriented movie.
No, but the sets were so rich, and the actors had so much performance that you didn't need any of that.
Oh, yeah. No, it was... I mean, really, this is a masterpiece.
I have a hard time picking anything in this movie that really I thought didn't belong.
No,
or should have, you know.
Yeah, I didn't really see. There were no like false notes by any of the actors. All the characters were in service to the story, which is refreshing.
And, wasn't a lot of fluff.
No, and when you went away to talk, you know, to have Truman with Jack, or when you got a phone call, or even when Nell was gone and she phoned in, you needed that. That was all to further the story.
Poor Jack.
Yeah. And, you know, you wonder what Nell did after Capote went. I mean, how did their relationship end? Were they friends to the end, or did he? I know he was in and out of rehab. So he may have not have had many friends left toward the end.
I suspect they were friends in as much as they were always going to be best friends, but I suspect that towards the end of his kind of spiral downward, I suspect he kept to himself. just because he would have been a big wallowing mass of self-pity. And I don't know. I'm speculating. And I like him. I mean, I like Capote. I like him as an author. Again, Murder by Death, he was hilarious.
Well, I mean, I want to watch at some point Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, I haven't seen it in a very, very long time. I don't know if I've ever seen it all the way through. But it'd be interesting to see it on purpose, you know?
If I'd seen it in its entirety, it would have been, I would have been in single digits.
Yeah, because it's, it'd be interesting to see. And, you know, how close that was to the short story or novella that was about. I think it was just a short story about the Holly Golightly character.
Yeah, but, you know, I have a... I have an affection for Audrey Hepburn, so.
Well, yeah. I mean, who wouldn't?
Yeah.
You know the only bad thing about Audrey Hepburn is that the actress who did the Audrey Hepburn story, who wanted to fashion her life around being Audrey Hepburn, was the lovable but not quite as talented Jennifer Love Hewitt.
Oh, dear.
Because Jennifer Love Hewitt is no Audrey Hepburn, sorry.
No, no. Oh, that's unfortunate.
And, you know, Audrey Hepburn was, maybe she wasn't even the best actress in the world, but she was so beautiful.
Well, she had a grace and elegance to her.
Yeah. Even late in life.
Yeah, absolutely.
And she seemed like maybe like a good person.
Yeah.
So at least that's what the publicist said, so that was all we need to hear.
You know who I think is the poor man's Audrey Hepburn?
Tell me.
Isabella Rossellini.
Yeah, I can see that.
And I like Isabella Rossellini, but sometimes a little bit goes a long way.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll have to think a little bit more about that. Well, you know who wants to be, who is probably life is really closest, much more close than Jennifer Love Hewitt, would be Angelina Jolie. Because she's doing all of the charity work and things that Audrey Hepburn did.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, and she's also a good actress who's very pretty. But she's just much more of a weirdo.
Well, it comes from a line of weirdos.
Yes, it's true. But another weirdo who's a good actor, so there you go.
John Voight?
Yeah, he's a great actor.
Yeah, I guess. He's a little unhinged, but...
Oh, yeah. He's a raving conservative madman.
Yeah, he is a nutbag, so...
But he was very gracious when I met him, and he's been very good in a lot of roles, and he does a lot... He still works. He does a lot of work. Whether that's because
you met him?
Yeah, you've never seen my picture with John Voight?
No.
That's on the website. I'll repost it on the Facebook page. Yeah, he was filming a movie at roughly the same time as The Frozen Ground, but his movie, I think he plays like a detective who's also a psychic in a much different movie with either Dermot Mulroney or Dylan McDermott. I can't remember because I get their names confused. But he came up to the office in which I work, and there were a couple of people that wanted pictures with him. And my general reaction is just to stay far away from celebrities and whatever. You know, that comes from working at the hotel. It's like, give you your space, whatever.
Right.
But, I mean, unless it was somebody, I can't think of the person that I would want to be like one of those people around.
Anyway. Harry Rollins.
No, not even. I can't think of anybody, you know? Like, I intentionally didn't meet Herb Chamberlain.
Because you didn't want to ruin it?
Well, exactly. You know, you don't want to meet your heroes.
That was my experience when I met Val Kilmer.
I didn't know you met Val Kilmer. That's awesome. That beats John Voight.
Maybe.
Well, anyway, with the John Voight story, it was very short. But, like I said, a couple of people wanted pictures, and he was happy to do them. And he went around to every, because we were all working, you know, we were all plugged in to our desks, you know, we couldn't move. So he went around to every single person in that room and took pictures if we wanted and was very nice and could not have been more gracious.
I think I remember now. I'm remembering the picture, I think.
Yeah, it's just a silly little picture, but it's kind of fun.
Also a little egotistical on his part.
I don't think so. I think it was gracious.
to go to every person has to have a picture.
No, it wasn't like that at all. It was like, I recognize that you can't like get up and come to me. So I'll be happy if you want to do, you know, yeah. Like, of course, you know, if you're going to come over to my desk and say, would you like a picture? I'll be like, yes, I do, Mr. Voight.
Yeah, that's a little egotistical though. Come on.
Well, he's a star. What are you going to do?
No, I understand. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm just saying a little egotistical, just to assume, like, I'm going to, put you on the spot. Want a picture with me? I'm a big actor.
Well, I think, if I remember the story correctly, and I was not in the room for this one, when Eric Estrada went up to the room and somebody wanted a picture with him, he gave him a big smooch. And while it was, I'm sure, flattering to the person, they weren't exactly expecting it.
So oh, dear.
Wow. It's like...
I was just molested by Eric Estrada.
I've just been Estrada all over.
Oh, gross. Anyway. He made it a verb.
Yeah. So.
No, I was lucky enough to meet... I was in L.A. Visiting friends on a crazy weekend where we went to Vegas, and it was a crazy 4-day weekend. Anyway, went to Universal Studios Hollywood and bumped into Val Kilmer and got to meet him and shake hands, and very, very nice guy, but a lot shorter than I expected. It was kind of weird to see him in person. It was, my mind's eye and the reality couldn't mesh, and so it just forever broke him.
Oh, that's funny.
I still like him as an actor very much. I like some of the Val Kilmer movies I think my younger brother would despise, so.
Oh, I don't know. I think he's a big Val Kilmer fan.
Yeah, but I like him. I liked The Saint, and I think he hated that movie.
Oh, see, I've never seen The Saint.
Oh, that's a great movie. I think it's a fun movie. It's a fun Cold War-esque spy-ish espionage movie.
Well, it's based on the serial, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, The Saint's a great character. Kinda. The old-time radio serial.
Yeah. And I also liked, Top Secret, of course, is a great movie.
Absolutely. Real Genius.
Yeah, Real Genius is good.
And you know, for the ridiculous movie that Top Gun was, he was great in Top Gun.
Yeah.
Ridiculous course, movie. Know, ridiculous.
Kiss Bang Bang.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Easily one of my favorite movies.
Yeah.
And no, also Heat. Drew's favorite movie ever, Heat.
Oh, I hate that movie.
Oh, okay. Excellent. Well, in our 4-part Heat series, you'll have to have one of the parts.
Oh, God. I think we all went to the theater together to see that. If I'm not mistaken. And it was like the most unenduringly long 3 hours of my life.
It was long, but it was great.
I did not like that movie.
I have not invested as many watchings of it, though, as Drew. So I asked him about doing Heat at some point. He's like, yeah, that's going to have to be my walk-off. I'm like, no, we can't have it that. It should at least be a big number, like episode 50 or 100 or 200.
His walk-off.
Like, that would be the one where he says, okay, now I'm done. I can walk off.
No, what kind of attitude is that?
No, well, exactly. That's. I think he's saying it should be far in the future because of that. I hope that's what he means.
Oh.
I'll speak for him, yeah. No, I don't think anybody's looking to walk off the show. I think we're all having a good time.
Yeah, no, you could. Yeah.
Oh, by the way, are we ready for feedback?
Oh, we probably should have done that at the top.
No, I think it's a good time for it.
All right.
So
yes, we're ready for feedback.
Okay. So the feedback was actually very simple, but it's from listener Travis.
And, oh, you're going to out him? You're going to out him as who it was?
Well, yeah, he's not just listener. He was guest host of the Sneakers episode, Travis.
So send your angry letters too.
Oh, okay. So you think I should? If you don't think I should out him, I can just put a feedback thing.
Listener, no, you can out him.
From Minnesota.
I would say in the future though, for other people who are not. I mean, Travis is fine because he's family basically. So, but for other people, feedback. Just so you know, people, we won't actually out you. So.
Yeah, well, you know, at this point, Travis was a sweetheart by sending feedback, but at this point, I think it's pretty much going to be. And this letter came in from Mom, who says,
VA from Anchorage,
exactly. Yeah,
God, it's a very small pool of Yeah. So I'm sorry to interrupt. So, okay. Yeah. So feedback.
Yeah. So, listener T from Minnesota. I don't have it in front of me to read it, but he said that he was looking forward to seeing. Oh, I love Comcast. VOIP, VOIP, what you get when you don't really want a landline. VOIP, because life is filled, short, and so are your calls.
Filled with the rage of 100,000 white hot suns.
So funny.
So, sorry, listener T from Minnesota.
So, listener T from Minnesota writes that he was looking forward to the Clue episode and liked it. However, he was surprised to find that the Clue episode was us talking mostly about the movie Murder by Death.
Which, well,
it's fair enough.
That's a fair assessment.
It's true. It's one of the movies that, because we, I know, I put like dropped a ton of clips in for characters, but there was no reason to talk the whole plot out.
Well, and I think the reason that we did that, and you know, everybody likes different things, but I think you and I did, at least I decided there wasn't much point in the plot because if you played the game, you know the plot. So discussing too much of the plot of the movie just seems superfluous. And really, I think you and I, and again, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you and I are kind of of that attitude. We want to encourage people, if you haven't seen the movie, go watch it. Even if you've seen the movie, go watch it. Just go watch it. There's no reason not to watch Clue. It will put you in a good mood. It's a good movie. And so I think that's why we talked. And this is a bold statement, but I think Murder by Death was a better movie. I think that's why we ended up talking about Murder by Death, because as much as I love Clue, and again, Clue is probably my number one movie, my go-to movie, if I ever want to watch something to cheer me up.
Oh, yeah. Clue is fun. Murder by Death is great.
Yeah. But I think we ended up talking about Murder by Death because I think Clue was inspired partly, you know, on the foundation of movies like Murder by Death.
Oh, undeniably. And so, again, to apologize for talking so much about, during our Clue episode. Let me say another thing about Murder by Death. Yeah, actually, but we want to thank, again, feedback is so important to us. And because listener T from Minnesota didn't get enough Clue, I will be sending him a DVD copy of the movie Clue.
Oh, that's very nice of you.
So, again, if you wish to leave feedback, the phone number for the show, which is probably the preferred method, because then I can actually drop your lilting tones right into the show.
That'd be awesome.
I was thinking about putting listener T's voice through a text-to-speech tool online and dropping it in, but it just comes out weird.
Yeah, I told you I thought it would.
Yeah, so next time we'll try to have, if we get any more written feedback, please, we'd like written feedback too, at show@notinacreepyway. Or at listenert@notinacreepyway.
I'll just have to read it in my imitation Jerry Lewis voice.
There we go. So go ahead, can you do a rendition of that for the Clue comment?
No. I would have to have some text in front of me to try and, because I will have to practice it. And it will be awful, and I probably won't do it. So, Lighty!
I was going to try a Louis Armstrong, but I have a stuffed nose, and I don't know if I could pull it off.
Louis Armstrong?
Yeah. Like, a la like, What a Wonderful World?
Yeah. Oof. Yeah, I don't know about that.
No, I don't do voices, so it's great. It's just unashamed.
Well, I don't do voices either, so, you and the Axel F, so.
It's my I can get my daughter laughing just by going beep 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 beep.
Well,
it's that pee pee at the end that makes it so funny.
Yeah, I think, well, pee pee is always fun to laugh at.
Pretty much when you're four, you know, it's what you got.
Yeah. When you're 40.
It's true, yeah.
As long as it's not your pee pee.
Exactly, yeah. This will all be taken out. Although it's funny, you'll notice in the Stigmata episode that we talk about some stuff. I'm like, oh, I'll be taking this out. And then I just decided not to because there's more of a story to it.
Jesus.
So, yeah. In the notes, right, like in the post on Facebook and in the notes of the show, of the download, it actually says, you know, and this is when Eric says all Norwegians are racist, but what he really means is...
Oh, geez. He had to put a clarification in.
Exactly, right from the beginning. It's like, and that's why I have to be careful of, you know, like just throwing out Jew jokes. It's like, since I'm not a Jew, it's not something I can just throw out some sort of Jew joke and assume that people, you know, people give me the benefit of the doubt. Because, no, right. You know, if you don't know me, you don't know me. It just sounds like I'm an anti-Semite, which is not cool. I'm not.
Right. Yeah, it's the same reason I'm cautious about making queer jokes.
Yeah, well, you get this, you know, you get the a little bit of a leeway, but yeah, you're right. Yeah, if you don't know you.
Yeah, but not everybody knows I'm a big, you know, a big mo. So sometimes I make jokes and people laugh uncomfortably. I'm like, it's okay, I can make these jokes. But that's really like that is like the anti funny. That is the evil opposite of funny. That's like, you know, funny's poor maligned little brother.
Yeah, it just makes people uncomfortable, which isn't really what you want. Especially since, again, none of us are super comfortable in other people's discomfort.
No. Well, unless it happens to be, you know, an injury sustained by a father in some manner of eating.
Oh, no, we're ruthless to each other.
Yeah, absolutely.
But at a certain point, I just think that was all ingrained in us that it's not... It's well, and I'm the worst as far as just... blurting something out that's inappropriate, but I assume because we're family, you'll just think it's funny.
Oh, I think you and I discussed at some point that I am forever saying the exactly wrong thing to my sisters-in-law.
Oh, yeah, well.
Like, and as it comes out, I know it's not what I mean when it comes out. It just comes out wrong, and then I'm just like, oh, God, you've done it again. You said the exact wrong thing, it's not what you meant to say, and you can't even fix it.
Well, and I'm much more... In all aspects of my life, I am way more liable to get in trouble for something I say than anything I would do. So.
Oh, I think that's true.
Yeah, that's. I don't wear that with a badge of honor. It's just a thing now.
No, I'm. Yeah, no. It's amazing the things that come that I say, and immediately I'm like, that doesn't even sound. That doesn't even make any sense. Why did you just say that? Like, what is wrong with your brain? What happens between your brain and your mouth that it all just comes out backwards?
I don't know how you feel, but as a man in my 40s, I think, you know, before when I was in my 20s and I said something stupid and I just want to smack my head like Chris Farley and say, stupid, stupid, stupid. Now it's just, no, oh, that's just another thing. Sorry. I'm just moving on because I say plenty of stupid stuff.
Yeah.
Didn't mean to hurt anybody. Yeah, just let's fix it and move on.
And the cacophony of things that just you know, ejaculate from my mouth, I'm always amazed that somebody hasn't thrown something at my head. So.
Well, and it's also, it's interesting when you realize that, turns out most people don't care about every single word that comes out of your mouth quite as much as you think they ever did.
Right.
I mean, in certain situations, of course, but yeah. If you're in a social setting and you say something stupid, chances are no one will even remember it, unless it's somehow profoundly stupid.
Yeah, even though in those instances, I always remember it, and then I obsess over it forever.
Oh, yeah, no, self-flagellation is a way of life.
Yeah, no, I'm always like, oh, God, I'm going to be alone in a room with them, and they're going to remember, oh, God.
Exactly, and I am, and now I'm not worthy.
Yeah.
Because the one to make a good impression is gone.
Well, and then what really happens, I say something worse the next time.
Well, exactly.
It's like, or, it's this one-upmanship with myself. I'm like, oh, I've just one-up myself again.
Well, my normal method of conversation for quite a while was just to nod and smile, and then when it became so uncomfortable with the silence, the other person would walk away. Which is a reliable way to do it, but it doesn't get you invited to very many parties.
I was going to say, my problem is I can talk and talk and talk and talk, as evidenced probably on the podcast. But, you know, I lack that recognition of when somebody's done talking with me. I don't know the art of ending the conversation gracefully. I just don't have that skill.
Yeah, I hate small talk. I'm not a good small talker with strangers. I'm more of a
strangers. I'm not around strangers ever.
Well, no, I'm more of a if it turns out suddenly that you're talking about something that I have some knowledge of or some passionate about, then I'm the person that'll just gush, right? I'll give you a half an hour thing, and you want to chew your arm off to get away from me.
It'll be scintillating.
Oh, I'll be scintillating all over them, and they'll be like, I just want to escape. Please, somebody call me. I didn't realize I needed to have a pre-programmed safe phone call to get out of this conversation with this weirdo.
You know there's a utility for your iPhone that can do that.
Yeah, well, at this point, I just suspect there's a utility for your iPhone that can do most anything. Which is a good thing. We live in good times. We really do.
No, I have no problem believing that even with everything that's crazy in the world today and everything that's going on that we are better off as a world than we were 40 years ago.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, some things are terrible and some things are worse, but in totality, we are in a better place. We've got better technology, we've got better access, we've got better medicine. All these things are good. And yes, it seems like some things are going backwards, but I think if you balance it all up, I think things are better.
Yeah.
We always, I think as humans, we have a tendency to look back and long for we long for the way things were. However, we also forget what things were really like.
Oh, exactly. No, you always romanticize the past or anything that you're not immediately in touch with.
Well, and so to tie this back to the movie, had this murder taken place in modern times, it may have ended up very differently because, it took some time for the forensics and the police to catch the killers. In today's world, I was thinking, how would today's technology have altered that?
It's hard to tell. Because they were criminals, and therefore, now their fingerprints and their DNA would probably be in the system.
Yeah.
It would be a little bit faster. But I don't know. I mean, it's, we still live in a world where technology is much better on television than it is in, rural small town America.
Oh, you can't get DNA off a damn rock.
Well, and you can't, even in a homicide like this, it's not like you're going to get the DNA test results turned around in a day.
Yeah.
It's all these things are going to take weeks and weeks and months. And, it depends on where you fall in line with whatever bureaucracy you're dealing with.
And you can't fingerprint dirt.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Again, in a murder situation, you can do all sorts of funny tricks. But if somebody throws a rock at your car, nobody is going to care.
Right.
Anyway, it's a different world, but it's this, these things still happen.
Yes.
And, it shows that there's, the death penalty is cold comfort, but, sometimes you need it. I don't know what I was going to say.
Do you think it would be a comfort though to you?
I don't know. That's the thing is, I don't know. I think it would be, you would be able to put a period on part of your life, I suppose, but I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I think there's a person I work with whose sister was murdered. Who Drew actually went to school with. And I think being able to go to court and face down the man that killed her sister was very comforting. And I don't, comfort's probably a bad word and I don't want to speak for her, but I think she and her family got some closure out of that. But ultimately it doesn't change the fact that they lost their sister, their daughter, it's still very sad.
I'm in the middle of, I'm actually probably more than halfway through, Joseph Wambaugh, The Onion Field.
Oh, yeah.
And so there was a amazing, it's an amazing book. I'm listening to it, of course, on Audible. But the point is made, spoiler alert. So if you're ever going to read this book or listen to the book, don't listen for the next minute. They've caught Powell and Smith after having killed the cop, and one of the newspapers interviews the wife of the cop and says, "Do you have a comment?" And she says, I have no comment. What comment would I have? Nothing I could say would change in any way what has happened. You know, I just thought that was kind of impressive and amazing for being the time period that the book was written from. But yeah, that's a point is, you know, the death penalty. Would it bring me comfort? I don't know.
And
would it bring you closure? Maybe some, but also, you know, would I want to be present? I don't think so.
Well, if you believe in the stages of grief, I think they're pretty well accepted, right? I don't know if it's
the Kubler-Ross.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. It depends on where you are on your grief scale, how you would feel at the time, because I'm sure you would be furious and you would want all sorts of vengeance. I mean, I can totally see if somebody hurt my wife or my daughter, my first instinct would be to just go and find them and hurt them.
Yeah.
And that's one of those things where, you know, it's understandable. And if, again, it would, God forbid it happened to me, but if I read a story or heard a similar thing where somebody did that, then you're going to assume they're going to go to court for whatever crime they committed when they did this vigilante thing. On the other hand, there are mitigating factors, and, you know, sometimes if you have to go to jail for doing what you think is right, then that's what you have to do.
Yeah, there's a, because I'm a crazy person, and my evenings have been taken up in this project that I've undertaken, this DVD project that is ruining my life right now. I've been watching The West Wing on Netflix, because it's all on Netflix now, and I've been going through it again. And interestingly, parallel enough, there was in the first season, the president's body man, Charlie Young, his character is brought to be the president's personal assistant. And his mother was killed in the line of duty as a police officer. And so the Martin Sheen character, the President Barlow, asks Charlie, we're talking about guns and the death penalty, and, you know, there was an appeal for death penalty, and President Bartlett didn't step in and stop it. But he was asking before that, you know, what Charlie's opinion was. If we found, you know, the man responsible, if we found them, you know, would you want them seen put to death? And Charlie said, no, I wouldn't want to see them put to death. I would want to do it myself.
In a death penalty thing? I think I can understand why you'd want to be there, because you wanted to make sure the bastard was really dead. You could say, I saw him die.
Yeah.
And there may be comfort in that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know.
Again, I don't know how you know, I've never been in that situation. Knock on wood. Hopefully I will never be.
Yeah. Hopefully it never happens. Knock on wood.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a crazy world. Well, any final thoughts on Capote?
Nope.
And so next week, we're going to have the thrilling adventure of So I Married an Axe Murderer.
Absolutely.
Excellent.
We'll stay on the murder theme, because we've been all about murders lately.
Yeah, we have.
Through Clue and Murder by Death and Capote, and now this.
Send your feedback to show@notinthecreepyway.com or call us on our new voicemail account to leave voice messages, or you can text us at this account to leave text messages. The number is 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. What are you waiting for? Put it in your phone right now, and then when you listen to an episode, you can just hit your contacts. Dial it already.